Shrink Wrap Radio number 691, Overcoming Trauma During the Pandemic with psychologist Dr. Robert Mueller.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is psychologist and professor Dr. Robert T. Mueller, who is a recognized expert on trauma and author of the award-winning 2019 book, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up. We'll be discussing his book along with implications for the current COVID-19 crisis. You can find out more about Robert T. Mueller by visiting our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here is the interview. Robert T. Mueller, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
Well, it's so good to have you on the show. We've been exchanging a lot of email back and forth, and we're here to discuss your book, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up, as well as the implications for the current COVID-19 crisis. And speaking of your book, I've got a copy of it right here so that people on video can get a sense of what it looks like. It's not overly long and yet comprehensive. So before we get into that, I'm curious, what drew you into the study and treatment of trauma in the first place?
Well, if you asked me this question 15 years ago, I would have given you a different answer. I would have said that it was primarily because of the research, because of a very inspirational supervisor in graduate school. And all that was true and still remains true. But in the last 10 years or so, because I've been doing this work for about 25 years or so, and in the last 10 years or so, I think I came to a realization as my parents really aged and as I had more and more conversations with them about their childhoods, that really ultimately what drew me to the field was their history and my cultural connection to their history. They spoke about this when I was a kid, but I don't think I really took it as seriously and thought of its profound impact until about as I have over the last 10 years. So specifically what I'm talking about is that my parents grew up when they were children. They lived through the Holocaust. So they were Jewish Hungarians. And so when they were, when my mom was about 7 and my dad was 10, Hungary was, it's a long history, but I'll just briefly say that was the most dangerous time for Jews. And so they were hidden and they stayed in hiding. You know, they didn't know each other or anything. They were little kids. But they were separately hidden and stayed in hiding for several months. So for at least 6 to 9 months, they were in hiding. And they really suffered and talked about that when I was a kid. And I don't think I really realized how profoundly it impacted them. I mean, I knew my parents were neurotic in their various ways, and they were and continue to be. But the profound fear that they lived through, which is the idea that they could die when they were little kids. My mom tells a very, very moving story when she was 10 about how she was hiding with a group of strangers. Her parents had left her with these strangers, and they gave them some money and everything. But anyway, there was a situation in which there were the streets were being swept for for Jews, I mean, swept, I mean, that they were being like, they were combing the streets finding and looking, going from house to house, sort of sweeping the streets, trying to look for, and in the house that there was this big argument because somebody was saying, you know, she's a Jew, get rid of her. We're all going to die if you don't.
Yeah.
And so there was a woman who said, no, there was a teenager, actually 16 years old. And she sort of held my mom and said, no way. My mom tells that story. And, you know, I get a little bit, emotional when I think about it. And she certainly does. But she came so close to losing her life. And so to be 7 years old, and to have that experience of, I'm going to die. Like, she was seven, and she still talks about, like, that she knew she was very close to being killed. And it was only because of this teenager that she survived. Anyway, my point is the experience of growing up like that, and then for her, and then for me to hear these stories, both my mom and my dad, had a big impact on me.
Yeah.
And I think that those stories and their experiences are what ultimately, like really unconsciously, really what led me to go into the field. And then in grad school, I did actually meet a supervisor who was very inspirational, and the research was very interesting, yada, yada, yada. And then I continued in the field. But I think that's the honest, reason. I may change my mind
definitely.
In a few years, but
it fits. Yeah. It definitely fits. And I'm half Jewish on my father's side, but I didn't grow up with him. But I assume I have lots of relatives that perished. And because so many people did at that time. And I've seen movies that kind of have that story in them, you know, of people protecting Jews and sometimes Jewish children, and but the whole dynamic of them being scared for themselves and ambivalent about whether or not they can afford to do that. So, that's such a powerful story, and it's really totally understandable how you've ended up in this field, and also how I would expect you would have a special kind of empathy for people who suffer from trauma.
I hope so. I mean, I think I've personally been lucky in the sense that I've never lived through a period of time where I feared for my life, except for, honestly, in the last month, given the pandemic that we're living through right now. My mom and I have had a number of conversations in which she's talked about how the idea of, you know, the prospect of food shortages, the prospect of losing loved ones. My mom is now caring for my dad because he had a stroke about 2 years ago, and he's mentally incapacitated.
Yeah.
And so my mom is now caring for him, and she, she's, you know, right on it and making sure that, you know, that everybody who enters their environment is wearing a mask and gloves and all this stuff, of course, which is understandable. But she's talked with me a lot in the last couple weeks about how feelings from being a kid during the Holocaust are coming back. The idea of the potential to lose somebody you love. And of course, you know, there are so many people who have already lost loved ones. In my immediate family, we haven't. So, you know, but I mean, the chances are high that every one of us will eventually know someone.
Yeah.
So the
current events are kind of triggering her.
Yes.
The childhood trauma. Well, we're going to talk more about the current crisis as further on in the interview.
Sure.
I want to focus on your book initially.
Okay, sure.
And so, as the field of traumatology has progressed, we've become aware that there are many different kinds and sources of trauma out there. Has your work tended to focus on a particular kind of trauma or population?
Yeah, so I work mostly with people who have suffered interpersonal trauma. So not so much people who have experienced, let's say, you know, natural disasters and things like that, but people who have experienced interpersonal trauma. Having said that, there are a lot of traumas that end up becoming interpersonal. So for sure, survivors of domestic violence and physical or sexual abuse who have very often, or developmental trauma, who very often develop what's known as complex PTSD. For sure, I work with many survivors like that, people who engage in dissociation as a defense because they've suffered so much pain at the hands of loved ones. So for sure, I've worked with those individuals. But even survivors of military conflict, so soldiers, combatants who have served, servicemen and servicewomen, they also talk about, so I've worked with many, many servicemen and servicewomen who have PTSD, or what's often called in Canada operational stress, but I mean, it's basically PTSD, from military missions. And they often also suffer interpersonal trauma because they feel very often a sense of betrayal by either their superiors, or by their country, or by the ideology that they've been taught as kids. So they often feel the sense of betrayal by those who they trusted.
Yeah,
so,
I can understand.
So there also, there's interpersonal trauma. So I worked with them as well.
Yeah.
So that the theme tends to be interpersonal trauma, or attachment-oriented, interpersonal, relational trauma.
The title of your book refers to the struggle to open up. Why is it such a struggle?
Well, it's a struggle because when people have been through interpersonal trauma, there is a lot of shame and humiliation that goes with it. So people very often feel as if they somehow should just, quote, get over it. There's a sense that they're obligated. There's a pressure people put on themselves to just shut up about it, get over it. And sometimes this is because of things that they've been told by caregivers. You know, this is our secret. If it's sexual abuse, this is our secret. Mm-hmm. Or if it's domestic violence, they're embarrassed to tell people that their parents are, you know, doing, you know, that one parent is abusing another parent, that sort of thing. There's a lot of shame and humiliation associated with it. So they hold the feelings in. And they've learned to hold it in. They've learned to use, in some cases, avoidance as a coping strategy. In other cases, they use dissociation, or they kid themselves that they're okay, and they may use drugs or alcohol as a defense mechanism. And so opening up to emotional pain, to facing the reality, and that's really hard for people. It's really scary. Uh-huh. So people try to keep silent, and they've also been taught that if they talk about it too much, they're being disloyal. Maybe they're being disloyal to the military, or maybe they're being disloyal to their parents if they've been abused in a home situation, or maybe they're being disloyal to their partner if it's a woman who's in a domestic violence situation. And so they're taught to be loyal, and they believe that, and they feel that, and yet they're holding the burden of this terrible secret, this terrible pain they're carrying with them. So opening up feels like they're being disloyal. It feels like they're being, sometimes they refer to themselves as foolish. Why, other people can get over it. Why can't I? So they blame themselves. They feel inept, stupid, as I say, they feel that way. So it's not easy for people to open up following trauma.
And are there cultural messages as well that we don't have a lot of tolerance for listening to people talk about the difficult places in their lives?
Yeah. Well, do you mean, are there cultural differences between people in terms of their willingness to open up, or do you mean?
Does the wider culture? We're all sort of busy and in a hurry these days, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, get over it already.
Exactly. Oh, there is, so often people will be told literally by friends. I have one example in the book, in chapter 5, where this woman, in one single case, so I have a number of different cases in the book, but one of the cases, there's a woman who her dog passes away, and this was her close friend. Her dog she loved her dog. Her dog was her close friend, and her partner, in fact, quite literally, kept telling her it was just a dog. I mean, it was an old dog. Her friend, her partner would say to her, "Old dogs die, okay? I mean, just get over it." And this is what she would tell herself. And so it took a long time in therapy for us to be able to even get to the grief work, because she wouldn't give herself permission to feel sad. Mm-hmm. She felt guilty for feeling sad. She felt stupid for feeling sad. Mm-hmm. And so some of the work had to be about helping her, you know, somehow not trying to talk her into grieving, but more working with her to give her the space to be able to come to a place where she could allow herself to grieve. And then she did. And then the work went forward really, really nicely from there. But yeah, people get these messages, shut up about it. Just, you know, and exactly as you say, you know, when you're going through your busy life, you feel that you don't want to be a drag on other people. Yeah. And so it's embarrassing.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, feel free to throw in other stories, either from the book or just from your own clinical experience, life experience, because that always kind of makes it more concrete for people. And we have a part of our brain is just love stories is built for that.
for sure. I'm happy to.
Yeah. And one of the things I remember from the book is that by opening up, it's not just telling what happened. Because you cite a case where somebody was kind of telling you what happened, but you had to kind of push them to go deeper. Talk to us about that.
Sure. So in terms of therapy technique, it's really important when therapists do trauma work that they help people be able to tell their stories in a way that is actually emotionally connect to their stories. So very often what happens is very interesting in trauma work. We talk about repressed memories where people have these memories that come back years later. In my experience, yes, sometimes that does happen. Repressed memories do come back years later. Absolutely, that does happen. That's a real thing. But it's relatively rare. More often what happens is that people repress the meaning of their stories. So what happens very often in therapy, is that someone will tell you, my dad would bounce me around a little bit, you know, whatever. I mean, people do that. And if you ask them for some of the facts, yeah, I mean, he had a gun and sometimes he would, you know, threaten me with it, but, you know, he didn't mean it. So they might have facts to give you, but what they cut off, what they split off is the emotion. And so very often what happens in therapy when you're doing good trauma work is in helping the person be able to connect the emotion to the actual narrative. And so the same story might be felt as different to somebody a few months into therapy, into good trauma work, in a way that they never felt about it before. And so that's the piece that sometimes that's really, really important, is helping people then connect the emotion as opposed to telling the story in this flat sort of way. And there's no mystery here.
Go ahead. Meaning. I'm interested in the meaning piece too.
Yeah.
So for example, in the example that you just gave of, you know, yeah, I've got this gun and so on, what might the quotes meaning be?
So it depends, but I actually was thinking about a case from my book, which is the case of Nicholas. I refer to him as Nicholas, and I believe that's in chapter 2. And one of the things that was interesting with Nicholas, right from the very beginning, when I asked him, I did the adult attachment interview with him, and I asked him for some adjectives to describe his childhood relationship with his mother. One of the adjectives he gave was good. It was a good relationship. And then I asked him for any stories, any memories, any incidents that illustrate the relationship as good. And he said, well, this is in the book, well, my mother tried to abort me. Oh, oh, the story's actually cute and funny. You see, she and I became really good friends later on. So he tells this story about how his mother tried to abort him, but tells it as if it's a cute and funny story.
Yeah.
Early on in our work, so I just listened to that, and I didn't push him in the first few sessions, that's for sure, because you don't want to sort of push different ideas on people who have trauma histories too early, because it's overwhelming. People have their defenses, and you know what? People need their defenses, even if it's substance abuse, even, you know, whatever it is, even if it's avoidance. People need their defenses. It's what's helped them get through. But as time goes on in the work, and as you start to work with a person and they start to notice that their defenses aren't really helping them so much. So this is very clear with people who have drinking problems, where they use avoidance, you know, drinking, let's say, as a way of avoiding. And it's very clear that the drinking has gotten out of hand. Maybe it worked at some point, but it ain't working no more. I mean, it's really a problem in their life. Yeah. With Nicholas, his avoidance, what was happening is that he could not connect in his relationship, and he actually was reaching his mid-40s. He wanted to have children at some point. He was in a good relationship, and he was so scared that he kept, any time he would get close, intimate with his partner, he would break it off with her. And so she said to him, you know, you're a commitment phobe. And he came to me and he said, that's why he started therapy. He said, I'm a commitment phobe. My girlfriend tells me I'm a commitment phobe. I don't know what that means. What do I do about that? And so where we started to go is like, how has avoidance worked for him? And why has avoidance worked for him? To the point that he said, but I don't want to be avoidant anymore. I said, okay, all right, well, let's look at this. Yeah. And he was ready to drop those defenses. He had to recognize that those defenses were costing him in his life. They were costing a lot.
Right.
And he wanted a change. And so we could then look at what intimacy, what scared him about intimacy. And of course we talked about his relationship with his father, and there was a lot of physical abuse. And that's the example with the father. Like when he started therapy, he would say, yeah, my father bounced me around, but it was no big deal. But then as we worked together, that really shifted as he started to realize, as I was empathic with him, as that was scary with him when I was empathic, and we worked it through in the relationship, what was scary about that. And in time, I mean, it took a few months. It didn't take years and years. You know, within about a year, he had made substantial changes in his relationships and in his life.
How would you describe your style of therapy? Or do you have allegiance to a certain school of therapy?
Yeah, for sure. So my primary way of working is psychodynamic and attachment focused.
Okay.
So... and when I say attachment, what I mean is using the work of John Bowlby, the British psychiatrist who developed attachment theory in the late 1960s. But I also work in a way that is relational psychodynamic. Okay. So I value very much patterns that happen in the relationship as they relate to patterns from childhood, patterns that occur in the relationship with me as the therapist. What happens between us, and where do things happen that end up replicating trauma themes? So what's an example of that? The client feels rejected by me because I'm going on vacation and says to me I'm a jerk and gets furious at me and walks out of my office and slams the door shut. And nothing strange happened prior to that. I just had told them about my vacation. And then they write, then they email me and say, I'm so embarrassed. I'm so sorry. I don't know what happened to me. Mm-hmm. So that kind of enactment it's just an example of what might happen. But, you know, I mean, the kind of thing that we would look at is what were the feelings that went with that? And, you know, invariably there's feelings of rejection. I'm going on vacation. I'm just, the feeling to the person was that I was just dumping her and didn't care about her and all of that stuff. But it relates, not to be dismissive, it relates to very profound feelings of hurt and dependency from childhood. And those feelings need to be looked at. And sometimes they get acted out in the relationship with the therapist. Mm-hmm. So I look at those enactments. How do those happen? And what do they say about the person? And I work with them gently without wanting to, to help them deal with, because there's often feelings of shame that go with that as well. So that's how I work. I also work in a way that's trauma-informed. And the thing that I like about being trauma-informed, so I it's trauma therapy. The thing that I like about being trauma-informed is that you don't have to be psychodynamic to be trauma-informed. Although I am psychodynamic, to be trauma-informed means to look at the issues of safety that have been violated in the person's life, helping the person reestablish a sense of safety in their everyday life, and to help them unpack the losses and the suffering that happened in their trauma history. And you can do that even if you're CBT, even if you use CBT as your main form of therapy, even if you use IPT as your main form of therapy or emotion-focused therapy. You can be trauma-informed with many different modalities. Mm-hmm. Again, I happen to use more of a psychodynamic approach through a trauma-informed lens. But in my book, I try to make it trauma-informed and useful for people who have CBT as their primary way of working, psychodynamic therapy or family therapy as their primary way of working, so that it can be useful regardless of the modality you've been trained on.
Yeah, I really appreciate you going into what's meant by trauma-informed, because that's kind of a phrase that I've heard in other interviews. It's kind of thrown around these days, I think, and you've kind of unpacked it for us, so I really appreciate that.
No problem.
One of the things that you talk about is the dangers of rushing in too quickly, and just from this interview, I do get the sense of that you're a very caring person and respectful of people's space.
I for sure try to be. It's a tough balance, and I think rushing in where that has been a problem in the past, where we've really seen that be a problem in the field of trauma therapy, was just before the false memory debates of the mid 1990s. So those of us who are in our 50s or older remember this. Clinicians who are younger, wouldn't necessarily have specific knowledge. But what happened was that there were therapists in the 80s who were very eager to help people unpack their trauma and to unpack it in an efficient, quick way. And what happened was that therapists weren't using good interview techniques and were using suggestion to their clients, such as this sort of thing. Well, do you think you're feeling depressed because there might be a sexual abuse history in your childhood that you don't know about? So that's a question that might have been asked in the 70s or 80s that you would never ask like that today. Never. So you might say, you think your depression is related to feelings or thoughts that you experienced in your earlier years? You can ask that, and then the person would say, well, here's what happened in my earlier years. But you wouldn't suggest to them that they have a sexual abuse history.
Right.
We never do that. That is a huge
court cases around that, and expert witnesses who are testifying to that's possible or that's impossible.
Exactly. And so that suggestion of sexual abuse was a huge error in terms of rushing in.
Yeah.
Kind of as if. It ended up creating a situation where people really, there wasn't space for them to actually examine their own memories of their own, their own experiences. And so good therapy now that's trauma-informed would never make that kind of suggestion to people. But you ask people, tell me what happened. How did your parents teach you the difference between right and wrong? What sort of discipline strategies did your parents use or not use? So you create that, you know, both sides of the question so that use or not use, so that people can inform in whatever way they want to without creating any suggestion.
Yeah.
Then you get the clients, what I talk about in my book, where they want to rush into trauma stories. And so I have a number of strategies there in the book when the client tries to rush in before they're ready. So let's say it's session two, it's a person who's used a lot of avoidant defenses throughout their life, and they just blurt out some sexual abuse story and then just go into the gory details. How do you gently apply the brakes, which in a way that is still respectful of the importance of their story, but yet says to them, this is a really important thing. This is part of what we're going to do in our work together.
Yeah, so how do you do that? You put the question, how do you do that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I have a number of techniques that I talk about, but the first piece is honoring the telling. So you might say to somebody, you might shift the conversation from the gory details. So I'm not going to ask them, you know, the person tells me this thing happened with my babysitter and then goes into some detail. And so instead of asking them for more details, I might say to them, I might shift the conversation very slightly. And I'll say to them, tell me, Lucas, is this the first time you've ever talked about this story with anybody? And then the person says, well, no, I did once talk about it with somebody else. And I might say to them, and how does it feel having shared just what you've already shared with me? How are you feeling about what you've shared? Oh, I feel really weird about it. Yeah, I'm wondering if you feel weird about it. It would be pretty weird because you haven't really talked about this with anyone in your life. And he says, yeah, it is really different. And I say to him, I want you to, you know, this week, you know, sometimes when people share private things, it's they have a lot of different feelings throughout the week. I want you to pay attention to whatever you're feeling throughout the week. And next week when you come back, you can tell me anything that you felt about having shared what you've already shared with me. So what I've done there is I've talked with him about what he's already told me, rather than having him go into new details. Yeah. So I've shifted the conversation very slightly. Yeah. So that's called honoring the telling. So I go into more detail in the book, but the idea is you help the person sort of put on the brakes around the details and shift toward the feelings around what they've already done. That allows them to feel contained in the moment. It also builds a bridge to the next session. And you can even say, we're going to explore this a little bit more over the next few months. So you say to them, this is going to be something we're going to do. So they don't feel that they've, you know, embarrassed and humiliated that they talked about it. No, it's an important topic. I might even say, this is very important what you've told me so far. Let's flag this as a topic we'll explore together. Okay.
Yeah.
And so then I'm moving away from the details, but I'm honoring the telling. So, and I talk about that in a lot more detail, but that's the sort of idea about how to sort of gently, the idea is you gently put on the brakes on the details, but you still convey this idea that the trauma story is important. It's an important thing. So that allows people to feel a certain sense of, they don't feel ashamed of them. It sort of diffuses the shame.
Yeah. And sometimes people will feel they've overexposed and feel a lot of regret, like suddenly I'm naked.
Exactly. And so this sort of circumvents that idea of overexposure before the person's ready. So exactly.
And you also talk about the importance of creating safety. And this is like one of the ways you do that. Are there other ways that you work to create that safety?
Yeah, I mean, so there are a number of techniques I talk about in the book, part of what's really important in trauma work is the therapy relationship, and then part of safety is about the person having some strategies to be able to regulate their feelings when they get overwhelmed. So I work with people to help them learn some safety strategies when they're in their everyday environment and they get triggered. And so first of all, identifying what those triggers are. Journaling is very, very helpful. And then as they get to know their triggers, helping them examine what's going on for them when they're triggered and what they can do differently when they get triggered. I also work with them to learn some self-regulation skills to be able to manage their overwhelming affect, their overwhelming emotions when they feel triggered. And so learning different strategies that help them be able to relax. It might be relaxation techniques. It might be different kinds of what are called grounding techniques. So all of those things I do. Yeah. And I talk about that in the book. But that's only part of the story. And many books on trauma therapy stop there. Grounding techniques, that helps people feel safe. Grounding techniques are not enough. They're helpful and they're really useful, but they're not enough. You have to also think about safety in the therapy relationship, because when people start talking about their personal stories, they start to feel, like I said, sometimes they feel humiliated. Sometimes they feel worried that you're going to think that what they're talking about is stupid. Sometimes they think I'm wasting this therapist's time. Oh, Dr. Mueller, he's got other people who have more important needs than I do. Why am I wasting his time? They have all kinds of projections that they create. And so all of those feelings that they have regarding the therapist can sabotage the therapy. And why do they have all these feelings? Because they've had really trying and difficult relationships in childhood. Their early relationships have often been saturated with shame and humiliation. And so it's very difficult for them to be able to trust the therapist. So working toward providing containment, looking at themes of honesty in the therapeutic relationship, that's really important. Validation is extremely important in helping create safety in the therapeutic relationship. Noticing when enactments occur. So like the client gets mad at you and says, you know, well, if you're going to go on vacation for 3 weeks, then you obviously don't care about me, and walks out of your office. Rather than just saying, well, the person will call when they're ready, you know, which is a mistake in trauma therapy, because what you had there was not just the person walking out and then feeling okay about it. No, they think that you don't like them. That's why they walked out. They felt rejected by you. So now how do you navigate the therapy relationship? It's quite tricky. You know, the person has walked out and says, I hate you. How do you reach out to them in a way that doesn't feel like you're pressuring them to come back in, but conveys to them that they matter to you, and that you actually care about them? How do you do that in a way that really is sensitive to the hurt that they've experienced in childhood? So that's also part of establishing safety in the therapy relationship, how to navigate those kind of what are called ruptures to the therapy. So those are all things I talk about in the book around how to create a sense of safety in the relationship.
It's so rich in that kind of detail. I mean, it's amazing that you can go into those kinds of issues in as small a space as you have.
Yeah, I tried for sure, and I tried to write in a way that was did a lot of editing, and I had a good editor.
Yeah, now you have a chapter that's on how not to face a trauma. What's that about? How not to face a trauma?
So, are you talking about the forgiveness chapter?
I think the title of the chapter is "How Not to Face a Trauma."
So, it's specifically. So, I believe that was the chapter where I talked about how so many people who have been through trauma experiences feel pressured to forgive, and they are faced with their own trauma story. They're faced with their own trauma story, and they have family members and friends who tell them, you know what, you've been holding on to this forever. When are you just going to let it go? Just let it go already. What are you doing? And they keep being told to do this. and they feel the sense of pressure. And so in the book, what I talk about is this idea of rushed forgiveness, that many people feel this obligation because there's so much stuff out there in self-help around the power of forgiveness.
Yep.
And I'm not anti-forgiveness. Forgiveness is great. It's wonderful when you can authentically
and
engage in it. But a lot of people feel pressured to forgive. Yeah. And so I talk in the book about the distinction between authentic forgiveness and rushed forgiveness, and how people in trauma, you know, when they have a trauma history, I'm dealing with this right now with a woman who faced sexual abuse when she was, endured sexual abuse when she was a teenager, and now she's having a lot of difficulty in her sexual relationship with her husband. And you know, I feel bad for the guy. I mean, it's understandable that he would be very, very frustrated. And it's also understandable that she feels inadequate, and she feels bad for her husband. But here she is, trauma memories are coming back, and she's feeling unsafe when they have sex. And so he keeps telling her, "Can't you just let this go already?" And she feels like, "No, I can't let this go." And so I feel bad for him, and I feel like it's, you know, he's not a bad guy. He's a nice guy. He's not, you know, pushing her in any, you know, unacceptable kind of way. He's just frustrated. And so this happens a lot with people who have trauma histories. Their loved ones often feel frustrated. They often just have this feeling of, "Oh my God, can't you just let it go already? What's wrong with you? Just forgive and forget, you know? It's in the past. Put it behind you already." And then they feel pressured. And so some of the work is around helping people slowly find language to forgive. But not to rush it. So how to do it slowly. And what has to happen before forgiveness is grieving losses. Before people can forgive those people who have harmed them, they first have to feel the loss of the life they wish they would have had. They have to feel the loss of childhood, the loss of innocence. And that can take several months or maybe a couple years of work to then be able to reach a point where they can say, "Okay, I feel more like I can let that go," and move forward. So it's a process. You can't put the cart before the horse, so to speak.
Yeah. I'm glad you, I wanted to ask you about the mourning of losses and applying that to the current situation that we're in now. Boy, there's just a lot of loss associated with this pandemic. There's the loss of life, which is a very big loss. There's the loss to the overall to the economy, and then to the personal economies of people losing their way of earning their living. So that seems to me to be a really big part of what's going on right now.
There are huge losses. It's mind-boggling, and I've never lived. I mean, I'm 56, and I've never lived through anything remotely like this. Between 1964, when I was born, and now, my wife and I, we're both 56. We both have talked about how we've lived, you know, personally, you know, relatively, we've been pretty lucky, you know, by and large. I mean, there have been ups and downs to the economy and things like that, but we've never lived through we've never personally, we're Canadian, I lived in the U.S., but I've never had to go to war. I've never had to, it's been pretty easy life, never having lived through a pandemic ever.
We were blessed. I'm almost 80, and I would say the same thing that you're saying, that I feel like I lucked into a period of time, where there was enough.
Exactly.
And it relates also to what you were saying to earlier about your what your parents had gone through during the Holocaust. Somewhere I read that people did go through a major pandemic like this with the Spanish flu, which I think was about 1918.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things that this particular research study turned up was that people didn't talk about it much. Probably due to the avoidance that you're talking about, and they didn't want to put it on their kids. And so they just tended to not talk about the people, all the people who died and all the privation. And that reminded me of, I've also heard accounts that makes your situation maybe a little bit exceptional, that your parents did share with you the stories. I've heard that many survivors of the Nazi era didn't want to burden their kids. Either it was too painful to even talk about it at all, or they felt that they would be burdening their kids or their grandkids to go into that. So there are kids and grandkids who only later in life kind of learn very much about that.
Exactly. There's a very interesting story that was written by Rachel Sofer, a psychoanalyst in New York. I hope she's okay. I corresponded with her a couple years ago after she published the story in the New York Times about her family and her grandfather, and how he never talked about the Holocaust. I corresponded with her a little bit because my experience marks, as you pointed out, a contrast to that. My parents did talk about, did share their Holocaust stories. And I think there's a lot of variability on that. It's really interesting nowadays. We do live in a time, it's interesting, this pandemic is happening so soon after the Me Too movement, I consider the Me Too movement a huge opening up to the idea that traumatic events happen in the workplace, the traumatic events that sexual abuse really is a thing, and it's a thing that really affects people, and it's a really horrible thing that has an impact on people's ability to work and their sense of safety. So I think that that's been the positive aspect of that is that there's much more discussion of the mental health consequences of traumatizing behaviors. And so I'm hearing now during this period, I'm hearing a lot of articles on how to manage during the pandemic, what sort of mental health consequences are happening to people. And I don't know whether, there was discussion like that in 1918. I'm imagining probably not. I'm imagining that there was not.
I don't think culture was nearly as psychologically minded as this period in time, that we were generally very psychologically minded, I'd say.
Exactly. I agree. I mean, for sure. So, I think that the opportunities now to be able to talk about what people are experiencing, to reach out and get help. I mean, just now the Ontario, so I practice in Toronto, Ontario. So that's for those of you in the U.S., that's a province equivalent to one of your states. And so the provincial, which is like your state psychological organization, has a roster of psychologists who are open to doing pro bono work for people who have have been affected in terms of their mental health by the COVID-19 pandemic. So that's, I think that's incredible that our psychological association has said, let's provide pro bono work for people who are suffering.
Yeah.
I know that my wife, who's a psychiatrist, her organization, the Ontario Psychiatric Association, is doing a very similar kind of initiative. I don't know about states in the U.S. in terms of that specific kind of thing. If people haven't, and if there are psychologists listening, to this podcast, I very much encourage you to write to your state psychological association and ask that a roster of clinicians be developed who are open to providing some pro bono work to people who are suffering. Because there's a lot of domestic violence going on right now. Think about if you're a sufferer of child abuse or domestic violence or any kind of domestic abuse at all, and now you have to be inside with the person who's abusing you for months on end. Can you imagine the psychological toll that would take? I mean, it literally is like being in confinement. Like, think about if you were in a prison camp. It would be like that psychologically. So there are people right now across North America, well, not across the world, who are in that exact situation. Yeah. And
I can tell you that the State Psychological Association here in California put out a message to relax. My clinical license is inactive. I stopped doing practice some years ago, but never gave it up because I always thought, well, I may change my mind and want to go back and practice again. So it's on inactive status. And so they sent out a message that people who are on inactive status during this crisis could go active without having to do all the jump through all the hoops that generally you have to in terms of more education and so on. And so that's one thing that I see. It didn't talk about pro bono. I know that I and a retired psychiatrist and another retired therapist, we are putting on a weekly Zoom group for people who just want to, it's not therapy, but it's like, hey, you're feeling isolated, you know, let's all support one another.
That's great, David. Yeah. That's great.
And I know we're not alone in that. I think
good.
I found out that I had a colleague on the East Coast who was doing something very similar. And I heard that Zoom was overwhelmed by people, by psychologists who are wanting to do online therapy using Zoom.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that is my entire practice and my supervision of my graduate students. It's all on Zoom right now.
Right now, yeah.
It's all being done by remote.
Yeah. You know, you're talking about the triggering, and that made me think of in the academic situation, you're both a professor and a therapist, right? And so one of the cultural things in higher education has been professors trying to deal with students who seem like they're getting way oversensitive. They're going in and they're complaining to the administration, this guy's triggering me. And what are your thoughts about that phenomenon?
Well, I mean, I think the usefulness of bringing language of triggering into the popular culture has been I think there have been some positive elements to that, in that people who truly have PTSD really do get triggered. And so, for example, I teach a trauma course, and I do have trigger warnings because I actually don't know if people who are students have psychiatric histories. I don't, ask students who enter my class whether they have a psychiatric history. I can't. I shouldn't.
Right. We're not allowed to down here.
Yeah. Nor would it be appropriate to ask a college student. And so I don't know if they have a PTSD history, so they may get triggered. And so I put that out there. It's not a huge burden for me to give trigger warnings. I think I try to be respectful in my teaching, and I try to make sure that people know that some material that we're going to talk about is going to be tough. And so I do give those trigger warnings. I think that when people get uncomfortable with that, I mean, is it a huge ask? I mean, it's not, I have a syllabus. I write down, you know, some of the material in this book or in that book is going to be triggering potentially. So please be aware of it. And that's my trigger warning. And they know, and it's okay. It's not hugely burdensome. So I think it's sort of just respectful of the idea that people who have PTSD do have a certain kind of need certain accommodations. It's part of the accessibility climate that we live in. And I think that's by and large okay. I think where there have been problems, in my opinion, is where people who have a certain amount of left-wing ideology will then punish others who don't have left-wing ideologies who are quite as left-wing as they are. And I think the problem with that is it ends up, in my view, splitting groups of people who by and large share fundamental values. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit of eating your young kind of thing, or, mm-hmm. you know, it's a little bit self-destructive. I think it would be more useful to find common ground among people who value the issue of trauma, value the issue of working with trauma survivors rather than trying to punish those who don't quite have as strong a viewpoint as you do. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that's where I think it can be a little bit problematic. But yeah.
Well, as we sort of get near wrapping up here, I'm wondering if there's anything more that you can say about what your work teaches us about coping with the current pandemic and eventually healing from it.
Well, I think it's very important for people to have support and people who don't feel safe to find as much as possible ways of being able to feel safe through this. Now, that's easier said than done. And I think that I don't have a quick solution to someone who's living in a domestic violence situation, right, or children who are living in that situation, except to say that for them to be aware that they're not alone, that there are a lot of other people who are in that situation, that staying physically and psychologically safe is really important. I think that when this is over, so to speak, you know, and I don't know when that's going to be, in a year and a half, you know, when, I think there are going to be a lot of stories that we're going to hear about people who have, just like people who have war stories, there are going to be people who have their pandemic war story. Mm-hmm. And there are going to be a lot of people who will have suffered in ways we can't even imagine right now, and who will need help finding their way to come back to a sense of normalcy. And it is going to be really hard for many people. There are going to be people who are going to really have substantial post-traumatic stress disorder from the pandemic, and it'll have a particular character to it. It'll have some unique features. I don't know what those are right now, but you think about all the different things that people are, and there are some people who are going to be facing hunger. Right? I mean, they're going to have a choice. Do I get in line to get a certain amount of money or food, or do I go hungry, or do I have my children go hungry and horrible guilt because of that choice? There are going to be people who are facing very, very just horrible situations right now that we as clinicians need to be prepared for when this is over. And any help that can be done now for clinicians to be able to get involved and provide some of their time to be able to give back to people who are suffering would be really, really important. As I say, to contact your state psychological association and see if there's a way that you can help right now, because we do have a technology, the one, David, you and I are using right now, yeah, that many therapists and potential clients can use.
Yeah. Well, that's a good wrap-up for our session. Robert T. Muller, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're very welcome, David. It was my pleasure.
The thing that impressed me most in my conversation with Robert T. Mueller is the depth of his understanding of trauma-informed therapy, along with his very empathic way of being, which very strongly came through even though we were on a Zoom video call and even though I'm not his patient. In response to my questions about his book, he frequently would give a sample response of what he'd say to a patient in therapy. His replies were filled with warmth, patience, and caring. I could feel exactly what it would be like to be his patient, and it was good. He was demonstrating some of the key points in his book, such as creating a sense of safety, a sense of earnest curiosity, being careful not to move too fast, and so on. It's clear to me that Dr. Robert T. Fuller has a highly nuanced skill in working across a broad array of trauma profiles. His therapeutic orientation is relationship therapy. However, both in the book and in our interview, he's quick to point out that his trauma-informed interventions will work for therapists of various stripes, including CBT. In relation to the current COVID-19 crisis, he's particularly concerned about those who have suffered abuse being forced to shelter in with their abuser or abusers. He foresees that this pandemic will create widespread and traumatic losses among those who survive. They will need lots of supportive help in the days, months, and maybe even years ahead. He urges psychological organizations to offer pro bono online help during the current crisis. I highly recommend his very practical book. Once again, the title is Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up by Robert T. Fuller, PhD.
Hello, everyone. My name is Nicholas Toko. I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for quite some time now and have really enjoyed listening to the interviews. I decided to support Shrink Wrap Radio for a number of reasons. I came across the radio podcast because I was very interested in Jungian psychology and found many of the interviews with Jungian analysts particularly helpful in explaining the concepts of Jungian psychology in both theoretical and practical terms. I'm now studying for a master's degree in Jungian and post-Jungian studies here in the UK and will go on to train as a Jungian analyst. And so listening to the podcast has become even more helpful, particularly because I don't have a clinical background, and therefore it's been, you know, really insightful to listen to and learn more about the clinical applications of therapeutic and analytical work. So thank you very much, David, for the podcast, and I hope there'll be plenty more interviews to come.
Thank you, Nicholas. Fan of Jungian interviews there in the UK. I promise I'll keep new Jungian interviews coming, and I thank you for your ongoing donations. And thanks to all our other ongoing financial donors. You know who you are. And thanks also to Sebastian Burkhardt in Switzerland for renewing his ongoing financial support. And with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. Thanks to today's guest, psychologist and professor Robert T. Mueller, PhD, for discussing his book, Trauma and the Struggle to Open Up, and the implications for the trauma of the COVID-19 pandemic. My next guest will be therapist Ian Spencer, MA, LMFT, who has a background editing Hollywood TV reality shows. He'll be discussing his observations about the world of psychotherapy and reality shows. I expect it will be a fascinating conversation. So this is Dr. Dave saying, let's all shelter in during this time of crisis and do what we can to support one another.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to to make you dangerous.